On the phone I have Vanessa Atkinson, the lead climate campaigner for Greenpeace, who have launched the New Zealand Energy Revolution, a comprehensive report on what action New Zealand must take in this very late moment of climate change. You may remember back in 1990, Greenpeace produced a very important report on global warming. Now, 17 years later, with time of the essence, Greenpeace has commissioned independent consultants to bring out a far-reaching blueprint on strategies we can embrace to enable New Zealand to be a sustainable example for the rest of our planet to emulate. Kia ora and good morning, Vanessa.
Hi, good to be here.
Vanessa, can you outline what this report covers, please?
Sure. Well, your introduction is very thorough and has sort of really, I think, created a good basis for our discussion. The Energy Revolution report looks at how we can achieve major reductions in greenhouse gas emissions from our energy sector in the sort of the scale that we need and the time scale that we need in order to avoid the most dangerous impacts of climate change, all without damaging the economy. So what we've looked at is we've modelled an alternative energy future, if you like, looking at the electricity sector, looking at our transport needs, looking at energy needs in the industrial sector, and looking at how we can reduce those emissions. The report, I think, was quite sobering for us in terms of what it has shown. It's really shown that New Zealand is paying a very heavy cost for delayed action on climate change. New Zealand has somehow managed to get itself into a situation where on the international stage we're seen as being very progressive on climate change and good international citizens and making the most out of our clean green image. But the reality at home is very, very different. We are one of a shrinking number of countries that have yet to do very basic things like put a price on our greenhouse gas emissions. Our emissions are going up and up and up. And one of the things that our report shows is that if we don't do anything, if we continue on business as usual, then our emissions are going to double by the middle of the century. And our report shows that you actually need to be going very much in the opposite direction.
Yes, I realise that. And I noticed that you mentioned that we've got to find ways to bring about change without hurting the economy. And, of course, both the carrot and stick as a method to bring about change. Can you follow through on this?
Yeah, well, it's got to be a mixture. I think if we look at to our European colleagues who've been onto this issue for a lot longer than New Zealand has, unfortunately, and have made some real progress on this, they have used both carrot and stick kind of approaches. So, one very basic thing the first thing really that you need to do to tackle climate change, as I've already touched on, is to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions. So what that does is it sends an economic signal to businesses and industrial leaders when they're making decisions, you know, to build a coal-fired power station or to build an efficient or an inefficient building or whatever choices they're making. It provides an economic signal about climate change. It gives them a signal to reduce their emissions. Now, at the end of the day, if we don't have that, then businesses are not going to be able to respond, really, to climate change pressures and to be able to reduce their emissions. So it's a really basic thing. The EU has already done this. Several years ago, they set up an emissions trading scheme, which basically sets a limit for how the emission levels that are allowed to occur. And then the business sectors have to, that they get a certain allocation of how much they're permitted to emit. And then if they go over that, then they have to find the credits from somewhere else. And if they go under that level, then they can sell those credits to those companies who haven't been able to reduce their emissions. So that's one way of doing it. The Europeans have adopted that approach. They're now into the second phase of their emissions trading scheme, and they're well on their way. An alternative way to put a price on greenhouse gas emissions, or at least on carbon emissions in the energy sector, is through a carbon charge. Now, this is probably a very familiar thing to your listeners, and sure will remember that this is something that the New Zealand government was talking about for many years, and in fact was very close to implementing at the end of 2005. But then in the wash up from the election, and it's sort of part of some of the coalition deals that were made with some of the minor parties, we had a situation where the carbon charge was dropped just before it was about to be implemented, essentially. And this has just set us way, way back. You know, we're really playing catch up here in New Zealand now. There's a certain level of almost desperation, I think, from the government, because they've realised, as you've already mentioned, that the tide has turned. On this issue. The public is now very aware of it, that they want action on climate change. And in fact, our Kyoto commitments are going to kick in 9 months' time, and still we don't have basic policies in place, and our emissions are continuing to rise. So for us, a first cab off the rank has got to be getting some sort of price on carbon. And our analysis shows that in the short term, we should be moving for a carbon charge. We've done the policy work, we can implement it quickly, and in the long term, we can move into emissions trading, but it's a more complicated sort of process with lots of questions about how you allocate permits and how you set the limits and so on and so forth. And we, as a country, need time to work through those issues. And so if we only move for emissions trading and we don't have an interim measure, then we're going to have a delay on action, and that's just not acceptable. We don't have the time for that sort of dithering anymore.
Yes, because a lot of us don't really. It's a big subject. There's transport. There's power generation. There's also farming, and there's forestry, and of course a lot of people want to get around in their car, or because they don't want to go on public transport because we've lagged 30 to 40 or even maybe 100 years behind in public transport, particularly in Auckland. So how do sort of mums and dads grapple with this, particularly with actions and things to do?
Well, look, you make a very good point. And just to expand on that a little bit, climate change is such a huge challenge that it's going to require action from all levels of society. That's from individuals, mums and dads out there, right through to local governments, to national governments, to the international community, and also the industry and the business sector. No one is immune from climate change. No one is immune from responsibility to act on climate change. And at the end of the day, all of us will be held accountable for what we did or didn't do to address what is actually the greatest challenge facing the planet today. So if we start at the individual level, what can the individual do? I think a lot of people often feel a bit, overwhelmed, that they, well, this is too big for me to make a difference. What could I do? But as I said, everybody in every level of society needs to take action. Lots of steps you can take in your own home. If we just look at electricity, for example, looking at how you can improve the energy efficiency of your home in terms of heating, looking at insulation in your roof and your walls and the floors, etc., taking advantage of the interest-free loans offered by the government to install a solar water heater, which makes up water heating takes up about a third of your electricity bill every month. So that's a huge saving as well, and not just for the planet, but also for your back pocket. There's been a lot of discussion recently about energy efficient light globes. That's a very simple step that you can take in your own home, and again, over the life of the globe, that's going to save you about $90 per globe. And if you replace three or four, then you're looking at up to about $400 over the life of the globes in energy savings. You can also choose a clean energy provider, a company that's only going to be generating or developing resources from that are renewable in nature. And you can use Greenpeace's Clean Energy Guide in order to choose the cleanest option in your area. But then there's lots of other aspects of, as well, in terms of how you get around. Transport, as you mentioned, is a major issue. We have the fourth highest level of transport emissions in the world, and our emissions are just going up and up and up in transport. We just really encourage people to think about their transport choices. Firstly, do you need to make the trip? You know, try to reduce the amount of travel that you do. Try to combine trips rather than making multiple trips. Carpooling where you can, choosing lower impact options, so public transport if that's available to you, carpooling if public transport is not, opting for cycling or walking if it's a relatively short trip, you get sort of the double benefits, not just the improved health benefits for yourself in terms of exercising, but improved health benefits in terms of reduced particulate pollution from cars. Cars kill about 400 people a year in terms of their emissions. So there's huge health benefits to all of this as well. The other interesting part of all of this is that some of the most inefficient use of your car is actually those short trips. So the trips that are less than 2 kilometres, where you're starting the engine cold, that's where you're going to have the greatest amount of emissions per kilometre travelled. So, and they're the easiest trips to substitute with walking or cycling. So there's some very sort of straightforward and simple things that people can take in their own lives. Also looking about, where do you holiday? I mean, do you holiday in Fiji or do you holiday in Northland? You know, I mean, looking at trying to reduce air travel if air travel is something that you currently do for your work or for your holidaying purposes, and see if you can switch that with options that are closer to home. Looking at your work practices, I mean, again, there's lots of opportunities for people to take this into their workplace as well, but challenging their workplace to develop climate policies, looking at their transport use, looking at their energy use, looking at how they can get those things down, looking to for their work travel if they can combine the trips, or if perhaps there's another way of doing the work through video conferencing or web conferencing. There's a lot of technological options available now, which mean that you don't have to get in a car or get on a plane in order to do the work that you need to do. And so working remotely and video conferencing, those sorts of things are very important steps as well. I think that also there's a couple of other really powerful things that people can do, and I think often people don't, it doesn't occur to people to think that this is actually a way to take action. But talk to your friends. You know, talk to 5 people about climate change. Tell them how concerned you are about it. Tell them about the issue. Talk to them about some of the solutions, and get them talking to other people about it as well, because it's by building a dialogue and an understanding and a movement around concern about climate change that we're actually going to be able to solve this problem. You know, so write a letter to the editor, call Talkback Radio. Don't shy away from that discussion on climate change around the dinner table on a Saturday night. You know, get in there. It's really, really important stuff. And flowing on from that, and another really important step that people can take is to talk to their politicians. Right now is very, very important opportunity for the New Zealand public to have their say about what they want done on climate change. The government has set in train possibly the biggest policy review of any nature ever in the history of the New Zealand government, certainly the biggest review ever on climate and energy policy. And they started that last year, and submissions close on the 30th of March. So, you know, time is running out really for people to to tell politicians that they're concerned about climate change and that they want real action. So that's one thing that people can do. Write a submission, which you can do from the Greenpeace website, or you can write your own through information and links that you can also access through the Greenpeace website. And make an appointment with your local MP and talk to them about what they're doing about climate change and energy. So there's no shortage of things that people can do and steps that people can take in their own lives.
Can I just come around to electricity, say, for example?
Mm.
You've got a lot of power gets lost in production and transmission. I just didn't realise how much until I read this report. But it's horrendous from what's produced to what actually gets to the out of the three-point socket in somebody's home. And you talk about local generation companies and local investors. Can you add to this, please?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's right. I mean, one of the challenges, I guess, of an electricity system is making the most of the resources that you've got. And any time that you have to transmit energy a significant distance, you lose a great deal of that, around 15%, but sometimes it can even be greater than that. So that's what you get when you've got all of your generation, for example, in the South Island, and you've got a major demand centre like Auckland in the North Island. So it's a very inefficient way to do business. And the alternative is to have a greater number of smaller projects which are actually located where the demand is needed. So so that means that you have less impact, I guess, per project. You can have greater community involvement and indeed community ownership of these projects. And you overcome that problem of efficiency or energy loss, rather, through transmission. It's quite an actually exciting kind of concept. And in Europe, it's very, very common. I mean, most of the, you know, many small towns have got their local wind farm of, you know, a couple of turbines just outside the boundaries that generates their electricity. And the other benefit of having a system like that is it actually makes the whole thing a lot more stable. You hear a lot about security of supply. Well, distributed generation, which is a small scale generation with the supplies close to where the electricity demand is needed, is a very, very stable way of doing things, because at the end of the day, if you've got, some major storm, for example, which cuts a major power line into a city, or you have some sort of problem which shuts down a major power station, and at the moment in our current system, that has a huge impact on users, and indeed can black out large portions of the population. But if you have a distributed generation network, the likelihood of all of those networks, all of those lines, and all of those generation sites coming offline at the same time is virtually nil. So it actually increases the stability of your system if you can get a diverse range of energy sources spread all across the country close to where the demand is needed. Once as well you've got distributed or smaller scale generation, you have the opportunity for the community to be directly involved in that, and that can be a very empowering experience and kind of the opposite of what's happening at the moment, which is I think a lot of communities feel, well, you know, disempowered or kind of railroaded by the big energy companies. And it's no wonder there's a lot of debate about energy at the moment. And I think that's a big part of it, because people don't have a direct say. They don't feel empowered or in control of it. But if they did have an opportunity to do that, to develop their own project, to have a say in how it was developed from beginning to end, to share in the benefits of it in terms of not just the electricity use, but potentially in any of the economic benefits on the project, then that's when you're going to really get a lot of buy-in from communities as well. So there's multiple benefits to distributed generation.
Yes, and with tidal energy, there's sort of no real prototypes around. I know that there's been some small ones. I think there was a little crowd called Rainbow Power in northern New South Wales who put these units inside rivers, deep down in rivers. And here we've got the Manukau Heads, and we've on the west coast of Auckland, and we have places like the Tamaki Channel between Rangitoto and Motuhee Island, where we put these big units down under the water and flagged it so nobody would take their boats around there. We could have tidal power driving generators 24/7, because if there's a leeway of where the tide is stopped for say 2 hours every 24-hour period on one coast, the tidal differentiation on the other coast would cover for that particular time. And it's so sort of sad that there's been no innovation there to be able to utilise this energy, I guess because we've had cheap fuel, cheap hydro and cheap fossil fuel up until now.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of exciting developments on the ocean energy front. So ocean energy includes tidal energy that you've just talked about, but also wave energy. At the moment, there are some proposals coming up in New Zealand for commercial scale ocean energy. They're still a bit experimental and sort of yet to be proven on the ground, particularly in New Zealand. But there's one up in Kaipara Harbour, and there is some discussion of one in Cook Strait as well. I mean, it is early stages, but there are definitely a group of dedicated engineers out there looking at how we could adopt this technology for New Zealand conditions. We've been a bit conservative in our analysis about when we see tidal energy coming on, and we've sort of put it coming in a significant way, really, from 2020 or 2030. But, I mean, some people have provided feedback that they think that it may well come online earlier than that. If it does, well and good, because that just puts us in an even stronger position and sort of able to make those emission reductions and that transition to 100% renewable electricity sector a lot sooner than we might otherwise be able to.
Because you're in the report, you want 100% renewable electricity by 2025. Well, if you've got the whole country behind you and you've got your media driving it, and I think this is one of the biggest problems at the moment, is that there's no one or a double page spread in the New Zealand Herald saying, okay, this is what we can do for our country to get the country going. And TV news, of course, needs to be able to say, here's the positive news. If we've got a whole country behind us, you can move this agenda far quicker, and we could turn it around by 2015, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the urgency of this issue is just so important. I mean, one of the things that our report shows is that we are running out of time. Globally, we need to be dramatically reducing our emissions by the middle of the century. And for a relatively wealthy country like New Zealand, which has historically played a big part in terms of our global greenhouse gas emissions compared to poorer countries such as India, then for New Zealand, the targets that we need to be aiming for are quite high. We need to be looking at about the 30% cuts from 1990 levels by 2020. That's not very far away. And then further, by the middle of the century, we need to be aiming for 90% cuts from 1990 levels by the middle of the century. And at the moment, our emissions pathway is going in exactly the opposite direction. So if we're going to have a good chance of, you know, turning this ship around, so to speak, and getting us on the right track, getting us on an emissions reduction track, then we've got only a number of years to get in place the right policies to start to change our behaviours and to get the right signals to businesses to start reducing emissions. Otherwise, we're just not going to be able to make those targets.
In the report, you've got a statement, decoupling electricity profits from electricity sales. Can you explain that a little bit more easily for us?
Yeah, sure. one of the challenges of the electricity sector at the moment is that they are incentivized to increase consumers' demand for electricity in order to increase their profits. So that means that they have to build more power stations in order to meet the demand. So in terms of the business signals, the business signals they are getting are that we've got to sell more, we've got to increase demand. But from a climate change point of view, it's exactly the opposite that we need. We need to reduce our emissions and we need to reduce demand. And at the moment, the maths just doesn't work out for the electricity sector. And we need to find ways in which our energy companies can make money from reducing demand. Now, that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but that's what we need. That's what we need to do, and it's going to require a change of thinking about how we think about energy, how we think about electricity. At the moment, we just think about, okay, well, how much electricity does it take to, you know, to turn a light globe on, or whatever it is that we want at the other end. But what we actually need to have a focus on is, okay, well, what are my needs for energy? Well, I need to heat my home, I need to light my home, I need to cook my food, I need to get the other food, you know, cold, all of these sorts of things. And so we need to have a way where electricity companies can be energy service companies, where they can make money by helping you reduce your demand through insulation, through energy efficient light globes, through changing the times when you have your peak demand, where you've got everything on at the same time, you know, working with their consumers in a way that actually makes business sense for them to reduce demand and reduce emissions. And that's sort of the missing link at the moment in the way that our energy sector works.
I think the unfortunate situation was, prior to 1984, of course, The energy companies weren't energy companies, they were actually public utilities, and they were here to fulfill a service. And they didn't really need to make a huge profit at all. All they needed to do was make sure that every house and business had the appropriate amount of electricity that was the continuity of it all. But since the sell-off of what our crown jewels, for want of a better word, to private enterprise, they have turned it around to say, well, let's make money out of this, and if we can get everybody to have a 42-inch plasma screen in their bedroom, then we'll make money. And I think this is where the energy companies, particularly the electricity companies, are now in this awkward situation, unless, of course, they can have all their electricity come from renewables as of now.
Yeah, but I mean, even if they move to renewable energy now, we still need to reduce our demand. I mean, energy efficiency and reducing our demand is a key part if we're going to be able to move to 100% renewable electricity system and indeed have a sustainable energy supply. But this whole sort of aspect of state private ownership of the electricity sector, where you've got, as you said, utilities, well, things that were once utilities, now still mainly being owned by the state, but being expected to operate in a business environment where they have to make money. It's all about the bottom line. We have a sort of a funny situation where we've got a lot of these bodies or state-owned enterprises who are operating their businesses in a way that directly undermine government policies and reduce the government's ability to meet New Zealand's international obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. So, for example, I'm thinking about solid energy. I'm thinking about with its coal business. I'm thinking about, up until recently, Mighty River Power, who were proposing Marsden B, the first major coal-fired power station in this country for over 30 years. These are state-owned enterprises who were essentially making money for the government by undermining government policy. I mean, it's a pretty ridiculous situation.
Can I swing this around a little more to Even though I think it's sort of outside your portfolio, forestry, is there any, have you any insight on that as to why that wasn't possibly not covered in this report?
Well, this is something that looked at the energy sector, that we've looked at a modelling of the energy sector. So, and obviously for the forestry and for the agricultural sector, which are also very important in terms of climate change, the picture is going to be different. We're going to have to take different policies. So, fortunately, we can't do everything, but we've started off looking at the energy sector. In terms of forestry, it's definitely a bit of a complicated picture at the moment. From Greenpeace's perspective, what we need to be focusing on at the moment is making sure that the land that we do have in forests that is storing carbon in terms of wood needs to be protected. We need to stop deforesting, and we particularly need to stop processes where we're cutting trees down to grow more cows, because then you get a double hit for climate change. You get the carbon dioxide that's released from the trees when you cut them down, and then you get the methane emissions from agriculture and the nitrous oxide emissions from agriculture, which are much, much more powerful greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. So you get a double hit for the climate if you cut down trees to grow cows. But you're right to raise questions around, okay, well, how effective is it to use forests as carbon sinks, or to use them to take carbon out of the atmosphere and store them? There are some questions about the long-term stability of that. Some research in Canada has showed that forests are actually act as sources of carbon dioxide. They're also vulnerable to environmental disturbances, fires, floods, and so on, which can result in forest cover loss and therefore carbon dioxide emissions. So from our point of view, we need to keep the trees in the ground that we've already got. We need to stop deforestation. But the focus at the end of the day has to actually be on getting our greenhouse gas emissions down, rather than trying to balance the ledger on the other side by trying to suck it out of the atmosphere and into trees, which buys us into a whole other set of problems and complications. So that means that we need to be focusing on the energy sector, that we, as I've already mentioned, we need to get a price on our greenhouse gas pollution, that we need to have targets for greenhouse gas emission reduction, so 30% by 2020 and about 90% by the middle of the century. We need to have an aim for 100% renewable energy electricity sector by 2025. We need to have policies to encourage renewable energy and to encourage public transport, and we need to put a stop to new coal-fired power stations. So there's a whole bunch of work that needs to occur, and we need to be sort of focusing on that side of the equation and looking at how we can also reduce our agricultural emissions and not give them a free ride, if you like, when in fact the agricultural sector makes up about half of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions. So our argument is that we need to stay very, very firmly on that side of the equation, on cutting our emissions, because that, at the end of the day, is what's going to save us. We can't plant our way out of this problem. It is just not going to work.
I'm aware that agriculture produces 50% of greenhouse gases, but only, in many cases, produces 20% of our GNP. So it's clearly an unsustainable industry when it's measured in this particular way. And, of course, and it comes a lot from our beef and lamb, which, of course, is the New Zealand heritage to have a hot roast on a Sunday night. So that's going to be a big change or a big challenge for a lot of people to have a look at their farming methods and also, I presume, their eating methods.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it's also dairy is one of our big agricultural uses as well. And I mean, New Zealand definitely does face some challenges in this area. I mean, we are quite unique in terms of sort of the wealthy countries around the planet, in that about half of our greenhouse gas emissions does come from agriculture, whereas many other wealthier countries, most of their greenhouse gas emissions come from energy sources. So we also need to deal with the energy side, but we've also got this whole other problem to deal with in terms of agriculture. But what we're concerned about at the moment is that there seems to be a bit of a softly approach on agriculture. I think that the government's a little bit gun shy from the whole fast tax campaign that the farming sector ran against the agricultural methane levy, which was to fund research to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. This is a policy that was proposed a couple of years ago and rolled by the farming sector because they ran a campaign against it. So I think that the government is a little bit nervous and do seem to be making excuses for agriculture. What our report shows is that we're going to be struggling to meet our greenhouse gas emissions, even in the energy sector where it's, quote, easy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions because we've already got the solutions on the table, like renewable energy and energy efficiency. With agriculture, it's definitely a little bit harder, but it is not it's not impossible. There's lots and lots of scope to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from nitrogen inhibitors, which prevent the release of nitrous oxides both into the air, contributing to climate change, but also into our waterways and causing problems there, from nitrogen fertilisers in agriculture. But some studies have shown that we can get up to 60% reduction, and nitrous oxide is a very powerful greenhouse gas, much more so than even methane, let alone carbon dioxide. There's also a lot of studies which have looked at how we can reduce methane emissions from our livestock by changing their diet, just simply by improving the diet of livestock. Not only do you get a better quality, higher productivity, as in more milk production, but you also get a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So there's a win-win for the climate and for the farmer. There's a lot of research being done into breeding lower emission cows and sheep, if you like, individuals that are being chosen and bred for their low emission qualities. And again, methane is an inefficiency. It's a waste product for the agricultural sector as much as it is a problem for climate change. So if you reduce this inefficiency in the way that these animals are converting energy from the grass to the milk or to meat or whatever the farmer is growing, then you actually have a benefit for the farmer as well. But I think that possibly the harder pill to swallow for the agricultural sector and indeed for the government as well is going to be maybe growing cows and sheep is not the best use of our land. Maybe there are better ways that we can use our land to provide an income stream for farmers, to provide an income or an economic drive for the country that doesn't rely on a high greenhouse gas intensive agricultural practices. So maybe we need to change how we do business, and that's a fundamental message, not just for the agricultural sector, but for all sectors of the community, from individuals right up to governments and across all greenhouse gas polluting sectors. We're going to have to change the way we do things. And the sooner we do it and the more willing we are to actually find the solutions and come to them ourselves, implement them ourselves, then the easier the ride is going to be. What we want to avoid is a situation where the tide turns against us, that our European markets for our agricultural products start to shun agricultural products from New Zealand because we don't have a price on carbon, because it has to travel so far, because our agricultural practices are poor, because our greenhouse gas emissions are so high. And this is already being discussed in Europe, and this is a very, very real economic threat, and it is one that is not going to go away. It is just going to get worse. So it's in all of our interests, not just the farming sector, but for all of New Zealanders to find solutions to these problems and reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture. What we shouldn't be doing is a sort of a protectionist or denying kind of response to this and excusing the agricultural sector or indeed any other sector from needing to make greenhouse gas emission reductions.
And how do you drive this, bearing in mind there's support that you need from all the political parties? They all have to, they need to read the report and take this information on board, but actually research and go deeper. How do you drive this and get the information out when the government couldn't even sell its fart tax because none of them talked about it? And even the last carbon tax that they were going to do at the end of 2005, I think it was 2005 or...
End of 2005.
The government just had no idea how to put the story across. They were not, none of the politicians were mentioning it, really. The Prime Minister wasn't talking about it when she's on television and radio virtually every day. So why are they? Why have they found themselves locked down?
Well, I think that the tide has really turned, not just in the public, but also politically on this issue. I mean, 12 months ago, we were in a very, very different situation. But now, pretty much every political party has realised that they need to do something about climate change or they're going to lose support from the voters. And that's very, very clear in terms of the rhetoric, not just from the Labor Party, but also from the National Party, United Future, all sorts of kind of unexpected voices, if you will, on climate change, together with the ones that have always been there, like the Green Party, talking about the need to reduce our emissions. So it's become a political reality right now, and I think that it will be a major election issue in 2008. So there's a real responsibility, I think, for people to get on board and to talk to their MPs about these issues, make sure that they know, that their MP knows that they are concerned, that their constituents are concerned about this issue. And remember that at the end of the day, people can move mountains. I mean, we have no better example than the Marsden B case. This is the first major coal-fired power station proposal in New Zealand in over 30 years. It was universally despised. It became the pariah, really, of the energy sector. And that was because of the campaign work of community groups and NGOs like Greenpeace, together with supporters from all around the country. I mean, over 4,000 people put in a submission opposing this project. People have been taking action for over 2.5 years on this issue by, again, writing to their MP, writing submissions on the proposal, changing their electricity company on the basis of what they were doing on renewable energy. And at the end of the day, people power has really won out, and we have stopped Marsden B. I mean, if you ever need an inspiration that this stuff does work, that campaigning does work, that activating people and getting engaged really does change the world.